I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the first edition of Punch Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I am Leslie Pariseau, and I'm joined by my co-host, Talia Bayoki. We are the editors of Punch, a digital magazine about wine, spirits, and cocktails, and you can find us at punchdrink.com. Because this is our first ever radio show, it's apropos that it comes alongside our first ever theme week at Punch, which is tiki.
Aloha.
Aloha.
Mele kalikimaka.
To get started, we thought that it was important to prep you on a few weird things that we found out about tiki in our research, Talia.
Tiki facts. So, did you know that prior to the adoption of the fern as one of the enduring symbols of tiki, during the Victorian era, there was such a thing as a diagnosed condition for an obsession with ferns?
Fern fever.
Fern craze. It was called petrodidomania, and it was common amongst amateur botanists who sought out the plants in the English countryside. So just think about that one for a minute.
It actually kicked off in 1855, so if you can imagine Victorians in high neck dresses getting crazy about
fern is a symbol of tiki and also of repression. So that's weird. Number two, take it away.
In Hawaii, Hawaii native Harry Yee, who is now 90 years old, was one of Tiki's most influential bartenders during the 50s and 60s. He worked at Waikiki's Hilton Hawaiian Village, and he was the first man to use the paper umbrella as a drink garnish. Beach Bumberry, who will join us later, speculates that prior to becoming the garnish perhaps most synonymous with Tiki drinks, the umbrellas were first used as festive toothpicks or hat accessories.
Interesting. So here's a pretty random one. The grandfather of Brian Batt, also known as Sal from Mad Men, founded Bali High, one of New Orleans' biggest tiki joints, which was built on the lakefront, called Pontchartrain. Pontchartrain?
Pontchartrain.
Pontchartrain. Beach. And New Orleans is a city with a long tiki lineage, as most of us know, and it's home to the Hurricane, a mashup of Bourbon Street, Insanity, and classic tiki. And incidentally, something called Tikioki, which is a Tuesday night tradition at a black metal dive bar called The Saint in New Orleans. And tiki drinks are served and everyone sings tiki-themed karaoke. And our own Sarah Baird, who is a contributor to Punch, once sang Do the Clam by Elvis while wearing a giant glitter koi fish temporary tattoo. So that will give you an idea of what we're about to dive into, this fantastical world of tiki and all of its magical weirdness. So just as a primer, as we get into tiki and give you a little snapshot of what we're working with here, tiki really starts back in 1934 with the opening of Don the Beachcomber's Cafe. Don the Beachcomber was a former bootlegger whose name was Ernest Raymond Bellman Gant. So the opposite, essentially, of Don the Beachcomber. And this, his obsession with Polynesian culture was sort of, all kind of picked during his travels, around the South Seas. And tiki, really becomes a fad sort of during the post-war years, but not before a competitor up in San Francisco, a classic North versus South rivalry, Trader Vic, which was the handiwork of one Victor Bergeron, sprang up in San Francisco around the same time. And together, Beachcomber and Bergeron, another tiki icon, Stephen Crane, who had Contiki's in Beverly Hills, helped define, among many others, it helped define the classic style of bars and drinks that remain today.
And tiki was definitely kicked off in the 40s and 50s, and it's seen its ups and downs. It sort of died out in the low lows. It was defined by a dark age when sweet syrups and very sad shortcuts came into play. And it died out and sort of got diluted, but there's been a resurgence alongside the classic cocktail culture, and we're going to be joined by a few guests who are part of that today. Before we get into that, a few things that you should know. Tiki is a conflation of many odd cultures. It's definitely defined by a sense of escapism, and that's something that we're going to explore in our first segment with our guest, Tiki Adam.
Ironically, greetings. We're looking at some beautiful ferns here.
there you go.
So, Tiki Adam, can you tell us just really quickly who you are and what you do in the tiki world?
Okay. My name is Tiki Adam Koldesar, and I'm a consummate tiki enthusiast. That's the way I would first classify myself, a lover of the drinks end of the tiki scene. So it's completely apropos that we're talking today. And in addition, you know, it's kind of spawned a love of Orgeat and a manufacturer of Orgeat. And so really, it's become part and parcel of who I am in my everyday life, you know. And that's the beauty of tiki, is the diversity of how it is that you can express yourself within this kind of subculture that really works out nicely. And you can be an individual among the tribe of tikiites. Mm-hmm.
Can you just give us a quick idea of how you ended up coming across tiki?
Ah, yes. The story. Now, you're talking to a reformed straight-edge punk rocker here, now in his fifth decade of life. And I met a wonderful woman. And on our first date, I had one of the five beers I might have consumed in an entire year. And I liked the girl. We hung out a bit more. And second round comes along. She orders a beer. I get an iced tea. And she says, boy, this guy's nice, but here's a challenge. Things go well. And my then and now wife thinks, you know what? I can't live my life as a wine by the glass gal. I got to get this guy hooked.
Woman after my own heart. I understand.
She wants the bottle.
She wants the whole bottle. So she sees that Dale DeGroff, king of cocktails, is holding a cocktail college at the Marriott Marquis, and he's going to do a talk on rum punches and tiki. This is back in 2002, and she enrolls me in that class, and Dale's, you know, the master raconteur, and he totally hooked me into the tradition and the arcane ingredients, you know, involved in the creation and execution of tiki. And it started me on a journey that literally changed my life. Mm. I was just totally enraptured. And back then, acquiring these, you know, falernum was unheard of. And I'd go state to state and liquor store to liquor store. And I compiled the ingredients necessary to execute these drinks. And, you know, this is when Jeff Berry's books were hard to find and small press. Mm-hmm. And so even getting the recipes was a real challenge. Mm-hmm. And I loved the hunt and acquiring these ingredients and the way people reacted to having these drinks. I mean, they were just totally transformed. You know, usually it was soda and something, but, oh no, I've got something that's got 10 ingredients. It'll blow your doors off. Mm-hmm. And so I love that entertaining aspect and acquiring these rare ingredients.
What aspects of your life changed when you came into tiki?
Well, you know, it's funny. It totally changed the way that we entertain, mm-hmm. And engaged me in a whole new world of people. And, you know, my whole thing was going out to punk rock shows, standing alone and listening to the show, maybe getting in the mosh pit, maybe not, and limping home. And now there was this tribe of people, and the interactivity between the people who love tiki and the camaraderie that comes with that was a whole new thing to me. Mm-hmm. And it was great because it was a level of interactivity that I hadn't had. And drinking, wow, this mm-hmm. is fun. Mm-hmm. It's great. So, you know, there's an alchemy involved. There's a camaraderie. And, you know, and there's all these things you can go to and people to engage. And my entire social life is really redefined as how I get out in the world and do what I do because of that cocktail college in 2002. It literally, whenever I see Dale, I always tell him the story. He's very nice and nods like he's never heard the story before. But I am indebted to him in a way that, you know, I can't believe.
So it's almost that you sort of traded one subculture for another, and it's interesting with tiki. There are really only like probably less than five that I can think of different genres within the drink world that have like a lifestyle associated with them, and tiki is certainly one of them. In wine, natural wine, it's sort of you're saying something about your politics, about what you know, what you believe. It's making a statement, and tiki has some of that there. But absolutely. Was it the drinks that really hooked you, or was it everything that came with it?
Well, you know what? My wife and I are very into mid-century, and she knew this would be a good fit. You know, the arcane traditions that go with it, the aesthetic was mm-hmm. perfect. So it was a natural match for me, and I had no idea before this class of the tradition in tiki, and I love tradition and things of that era, you know, mm-hmm. the way things used to be done. So there's a real attraction, and you know, within mm-hmm. each of the subcultures within tiki, they'll tell you the same thing from that, you know, their own point of view mm-hmm. in terms of their individual interests in mm-hmm. tiki. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a very attractive thing, and that they're, you know, for the people that love the clothing and the artifact collectors and the music people mm-hmm. and each one of them are equally passionate about that aspect of tiki, and they like, and I like all that other stuff, but they're passionate maybe about one or more of those subcultures.
Mm-hmm. Have you found, we actually haven't said what you do professionally outside of tiki. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us really quickly what you do?
What I do is I'm a speech language pathologist that specializes in childhood feeding disorders. Mm-hmm. So I work with kids that have sensory motor issues that disable them from consuming normal food, mm-hmm. regular food. Mm-hmm. And I work with the kids and their families to help them adapt and relearn about food the way that you and I take for granted, mm-hmm. you know, because food to these kids, the kids that I work with, is a threat. And what they'll do is they'll self-restrict their diet down to two or three or four foods. Mm-hmm. You know, like one of my most extreme cases, all this three-year-old ate was Trix, Go-Gurt, and Fuse iced tea. That was his entire diet.
If only we can give these kids like a hurricane. Like, I feel I like know. It's just at like, it's going to be fine.
It's definitely in the spectrum of
try
acceptance.
Try this.
Have you found any sort of overlap with what you do professionally and the world of tiki?
Well, you know, it's interesting, you know, the mindset, you know. So within the subsect of speech language pathology, I'm like this ultra, ultra specialist. And it's an unusual profession, and you know, I find it interesting in that sense. You know, the research, the learning, you know, the interaction with people, mm-hmm. it kind of tides over to the research interaction of people as it relates to finding these recipes. You know, and Jeff Berry, who will be speaking later, he's the Indiana Jones. I mean, he's unearthed. You know, he's here. They are, guys. Now, it's up to you to find all these materials. And if you can, I'll give you some, you know, tips and pointers. But I just love that mm-hmm. that same, you know, singularly dedicated pursuit. Same thing with unlocking a drink, unlocking what's going on with this kid that prevents him from eating food. So it's the detective work. It's mm-hmm. digging and finding and making it happen, you know, whether it be for entertainment or to help this kid sit down to a normal meal.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you bring up Beach Bombari and him being sort of this Indiana Jones figure. And there is in tiki sort of this lineage that you start to see where there is like a godfather. There is like a, you know, it goes from like Don the Beachcomber, Trader Vic, these people who are adopting names that are obviously not their own names. You, Tiki Adam, being one
absolutely.
Of them.
Absolutely.
So there is this sort of like, I don't know if it's maybe tied to some sort of undertone of like that deism that is kind of, you know, a kind of throughout tiki, or if it is this like sort of a self-mythology? For us, we're trying to understand sort of the tiki psyche. It is like, in a way, kind of like the Star Trek of, it's like the Trekkies of cocktails.
Please. We exactly. In terms of
it's geekdom, a lot of, there's role play. There's like a role playing aspect
playing,
for sure.
And
it's like D&D,
like
gaming.
Joe Desmond, who you'll speak to here. Uh-huh. I call him the Dean of Hosts. This guy, unbelievable the way he opens up his home. And you're right, because each one of us has a part to play in this. Mm-hmm. and there's friendly competition in there, but you're absolutely right. Just as it was back in the day when Don first propagated tiki, and you know, then you have Trader Vic recognizing a good thing, a smart businessman. I got to replicate this. And you know, he's obviously the most successful imitator of Don. But there again, Steve Crane, a total wacky guy, but smart. And everybody has their part to play. And that's what creates the brocade in any subculture. So you have, exactly, I'm the guy who does orgeat. You know, Joe's the consummate host. Everybody, and then you have all your special, you got Brian Miller, the pirate dude. You know, and you got, so everybody does have an identity and a handle, and it, when it's integrated, it's fantastic because it adds diversity within this kind of seemingly homogenous group.
It's true. And the interesting thing about tiki is these figures have been enduring in a way that I don't think you see in other cocktail genres. We talk a lot about Jerry Thomas, but when someone asks someone like, who is this like seminal figure in history, you know, in classic cocktails, I think that they'd have a harder time picking people out. But in tiki, we can rattle off five people. There is a sort of sense of immortality in that role playing.
And that's right. And that's good business.
Yeah.
I mean, that too. Don created that persona.
Yeah.
And this was an A-list activity. You know, he had all the A-listers in his day. In Don the Beachcombers was the place to be. You know, Gloria Swanson and Howard Hughes and Bing Crosby and, you know, all tiki files.
Yeah.
And loving this completely new drinks form, a uniquely American drinks form. Just, you know, created out of the necessity of having post-prohibition rum being most plentiful and cheapest, and Don's intimate familiarity with that rum.
Yeah.
That's a great point to bring up about the time period. And one of the things that we've been discovering is that tiki was very much post-war, and it not necessarily reactionary, but post-World War II, people were looking for some sort of escape, and tiki sort of provided this other world that they could jump into that was lush and tropical and beautiful and sort of an oasis away from this horrible thing that America had just gone through. And so we've sort of been wondering, you know, because there's a tiki revival now, why are we escaping now? What is it about the second revival? What are we trying to get away from or remember?
Well, I'll give you my take on it and my opinion. When I look at tiki and I look at the now is all social media, digital, what's on the plasma screen, this, that, and the other. Tiki, to me, is an escape from that, the mundanity. The saddest thing I see at any given bar is the illuminated faces of everybody at the bar not interacting with each other. And so it breaks my heart to see a TV in a tiki bar. That's antithetical to the whole thing. So I feel like we are escaping this disconnection via all the digital media. And this is a way to go back to a bit simpler time when it was no cell phones, just you had to talk to the person next to you. And the drinks are what draw you and are the conversation pieces. It's not just something in a glass. It's, wow, look, dude, check that
out. It's on fire.
And it's on fire. Yeah. And we're engaging each other now. Yeah. And it's fun.
Yeah.
And it's a little silly and hokey, but at the same time, these drinks are delicious, and it's a way to connect.
I think that's a really astute observation. And I think that that's probably a really good segue into our next segment. So before that, we will take a little break. I'm Leslie Pariseau, and this is Talia Bayoki. And thank you, Adam, Tiki
Absolutely.
Adam.
This is Punch Radio.
Joining us.
We'll see you in a bit.
This is the story of men and women who shed not only their clothes, but also their...
Welcome back to Punch Radio. We are from Punch Magazine, and you can find us at punchdrink.com. We are your hosts. I'm Leslie Pariseau, and I'm joined by Talia Bayocchi. And this week's show is all about tiki, and it's in correspondence to our first ever theme week at Punch, which is all about tiki. And we have pieces on everything from falernum to the tiki psyche to the tiki fern, which brings us to our second guest, Reagan Hoffman. She's a regular contributor to Punch, and she writes about everything from the evolution of the champagne flute to the very odd rabbit hole of tiki ferns. It is one of the sexier oddities in tiki, and I'll let Talia tell a little bit more about it.
Yeah, so as we mentioned earlier, tiki is sort of this weird conflation of Hawaiian, Caribbean, Indonesian cultures, none of them particularly accurate. And it's sort of this weird mix, these different things and how they come together. And aside from sort of their obvious tropical vibes, there's really like one thing that these places all have in common. And that is the fern.
Pretty much the most mundane plant you can think of is somehow also the most exotic when it comes to these bars.
Let's first talk about this Victorian thing again. And I don't understand how the Victorians had this crazy obsession with ferns, and how somehow the fern went from being this weird sort of twee Victorian thing to this exotic symbol of tiki.
We did a little research, but I think you need to fill us in a little bit more.
Yeah. So the Victorians needed a lot of activities to keep themselves, keep their minds off of what they were repressing. And one of those activities was basically fern gathering. It was particularly popular among young women, kind of in the mid to late 19th century. And they would go out. It was sort of when rail travel was taking root in the UK, and so they could leave London and go out into the countryside and actually collect ferns. And so,
to be clear, though, this was not an American thing.
No, America somehow got away with no fern craze. Yeah. But I heard that also, like that this fern gathering, there was such a fever that there was actually a fern shortage, where there are certain varieties of ferns that are now extinct because of all the gathering. So this has nothing to do with tiki at all, but I think it sets up the strangeness of the fern as this object of tiki affection. So I guess the first is sort of, in your research, how did the fern, how does the fern play into tiki, and what does it symbolize?
So there's two kinds of fern that really pop up over and over again in the tiki
and
world.
No one has a straight face right now. I just want to make that clear.
I have to say that when we were first discussing this story, I was just like, ferns? Really? And the more I went into it, the weirder and weirder it got. As with most tiki things, the farther you dig, the crazier it gets. Yeah. And the more fascinating and wonderful, of course. Yeah. So the fern, there really are two different aspects of it. There's the tree fern, which are these enormous, they look like palm trees, basically. Yeah. And they're what you see, the big figures that you see carved, kind of the Easter Island type guys, the sort of statues that you'll see outside of restaurants. Those are tree ferns. And those really became popular in Hawaii and about after the sort of Don the Beachcomber sort of first became a thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's also just plain old ferns, like you would have in this radio studio right here, like your great aunt probably had in her living room, just plain old ferns. And they were used to sort of act as screens and just sort of try to replicate the lush greenery that you see in the tropics. Mm-hmm. When Don the Beachcomber was first building his restaurant, he sort of used all these bits and bobs that he'd collected mm-hmm. on his travels. He'd actually traveled the South Pacific as a young man and brought back kind of whatever he could carry. Mm-hmm. And he was just trying to build this oasis, this mm-hmm. escape, and mm-hmm. ferns were a really great kind of filler mm-hmm. that added a kind of a tropical vibe.
Mm-hmm. Can you revisit that aspect of the screen? What do you mean by that?
So one of the most interesting things and one of the first uses where they really came into prominence was at Don the Beachcomber, mm-hmm. where they were used to hide this really elaborate intercom system where basically there were two bars. There was a front bar that everyone could see where there were, very nattily dressed white bartenders who would mix you a martini if you wanted and all the sort of traditional bar stuff. And then there was a back bar hidden, which was staffed entirely by Filipino bartenders who did all the heavy lifting, who mm-hmm. actually made all the tiki drinks. So if you ordered something kind of normal, you got it from the normal bar. And if you ordered something tiki, you got it from the secret tiki bar. And the way those orders were communicated was waiters would whisper in
whisper into the ferns.
Into yeah. the ferns. Yeah. So it was as if they appeared, you know, out of nowhere from the mists in this sort of tropical wonderland.
This is actually when we first found out about the tiki fern. This is how we discovered it. And I can't remember who we were talking to, but we were definitely sitting in a bar. And she was telling us about the waiters who would go talk to the ferns, and they were like, this has to be something
You're
really
lying.
Wild.
Yeah.
Like, we've got to figure out more about this, and this is how we eventually assigned the story to Reagan.
Yeah. It's
And why was the bar, this is a question that I don't know if anyone really knows the answer to, and it's a tough one, but why were these bartenders hidden? Was it like sort of Tiki's way of having this speakeasy vibe? Was it like, was there a sort of, you know, mystery and exoticism in hiding these drinks as if they were coming from some tropical island to your table? Was that the
Yeah,
M.O.?
I think it was more the latter. You know, it's tough when you talk about this tiki stuff because you kind of get into some weird racial uncomfortableness, you know.
Well, I think in all of it.
All of it, exactly. It's all about this idea of another culture that nobody really actually understood when they were trying to replicate mm-hmm. it. It's like, it's, you know, you could think about it as, you know, like a blackface restaurant. Like, it's really weird. And if you think too hard about it, it gets kind of uncomfortable.
It does. It's sort of like all of these weird accoutrements that are conflated from different cultures. And that's everything from, you know, just very simply a pineapple to a carved mask. But that actually leads us into another aspect that we're exploring this Tiki Week at Punch. And that is the tiki garnish. And I think, like, we've talked a lot about, like, what the function of tiki garnish is. And a lot of times it's not functional at all. It's just mm-hmm. like, it's just beautiful.
Yeah. Sometimes it's actually anti-functional. It gets in the way of you drinking your drink because it's so big and elaborate.
And it's funny because some people say, you know, sometimes it's not even so much about the drink as the garnish actually in some instances becomes more important than the drink. And I think it's meant to communicate something, and whether that's escapism or whether it's used as a function to, you know, sort of one-upmanship, you know.
Yeah.
And it seems now that, like, the function of garnish, you see, has gone through different sort of stages. And it's gone from, you know, I think, you know, people building on tradition to now where you have, like, what is the function of a flaming Oreo? Is this an existential question? I'm not even sure.
When we talk about the flaming Oreo, we're referring to one of Brian Miller's Tiki Monday stunts where he soaked an Oreo in absinthe and lit it on fire, which is derivative of sort of the flaming lime hull that you pour an overproof spirit into and light on fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It really is taking on a tradition, but just completely turning it on its head and making it your own, which is, I think, what we're seeing happening now.
Yeah. For you personally, I mean, as a lover of tiki and what, like, how do you, like, how is the garnish significant to you, and sort of, and what is it when you go out and you have tiki drinks? What is it about sort of all of the aspects beyond the drink? We know what the drink are. The drinks are, you know, very elaborate, and there's lots of rum. But what about the rest of it do you find attractive, and you know, how does it enhance your own drinking experience?
You know, the garnish, I think, just really plays into the idea of the tiki as aesthetic. You know, mm-hmm. Tiki Adam was sort of touching on it just at the end of your segment there. You know, it's about the whole thing is beautiful. It's not just, you know, the bars themselves are built beautifully. Mm-hmm. They've got, you know, maybe they've got some ferns lying around.
Mm-hmm.
And the glassware is always really interesting. Everything mm-hmm. is very unique to where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is incredibly beautiful to look at and mm-hmm. interesting and kind of catches your eye in a bunch of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You're never sort of staring into space mm-hmm. in a tiki bar. You're always looking at something and sort of taking something different in. There's all these different aspects. And the garnish, I think, is really part of that. You know, mm-hmm. it's another way to engage you with your drink before mm-hmm. you even mm-hmm. take a sip.
Yeah.
You get this creation, and mm-hmm. that's what it is. It's a creation. You know, it's got a crazy name.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a list of ingredients a mile long. And then it arrives, and it's in this super elaborate glassware. Maybe it's in a mug shaped like mm-hmm. a tiki idol. Maybe it's in a hollowed out pineapple or coconut or whatever, or even further these days. And then you've got the garnish, and that just sort of, it's like the drink is coming out at you.
Yeah.
And it's inviting you in. It's sort of reaching out toward
it's
you.
It's interactive.
Yeah. It's totally interactive. Yeah.
I like to imagine the ultimate tiki garnish and what that would be like. You know, like if we'd, or we, like, could we top, what is the craziest garnish you've ever seen? And how, like, what could, Brian Miller had said in a piece that one of our writers was working on, that there was a punch bowl where it was brought out by a woman in hula, and she would present the punch bowl, and she would stroke the cheek of the person who had ordered the punch bowl, and that was sort of the ultimate garnish. And I think that was an amazing thing to say. It was just like, that is really where that's
truly,
that is
interactive.
The mecca for tiki, you know. Yeah. This elaborate sort of combination of ridiculous and also like really sweet, you know.
Yeah, I've never personally encountered it, but in Chicago at Three Dots and a Dash, yeah, apparently they do a banana dolphin.
The dolphin.
You know, we just came from a tiki shoot this morning.
Made a dolphin.
I made a dolphin. I got up at 8 a.m. and I got into the kitchen and I made a dolphin. Mm-hmm. Okay, it didn't make it into a drink. I was really focused on getting that lime hull to light on fire this morning. Yeah. So I sort of bypassed the banana, but it's in one of those bags over there. So we are in the presence of a banana.
Of a real live banana dolphin.
There's a real live banana dolphin somewhere in here.
Could figure out a way to light that on fire, and then maybe have like orchids, like a lay of orchids around it, I think that would be the ultimate tiki garnish.
I think that's a great Instagram goal for next week.
And that is a challenge to you, Leslie.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Reagan. I think that we've gotten definitely deep into this weird world of tiki.
I think we all hope that we see more ferns in the future. Yes. And that's something that I'm very serious about that. I hope we see more ferns.
Absolutely. If you walk into a tiki bar and you see ferns, you know you're in the right place.
America's do.
Yes.
Clearly.
The ferns are coming back.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a quick break and we will be back. You are listening to Punch Radio on Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back. This is Punch Radio. I'm Talia Bayoki, and I am joined by my co-host, Leslie Pariseau, and we're talking about tiki. And as you know, tiki is one of the weirder categories of the cocktail world, and something that is, I think, misunderstood in a lot of ways, and we're kind of getting behind the fern, as you will, to learn a little bit more about all of these parrots and bamboo and flaming coconuts to understand really what is behind tiki. And so we're joined by Joe Desmond, who has a famous home bar in New York with his wife, Nicole Desmond, and they throw legendary tiki parties. And anyone in the New York cocktail world is pretty well acquainted with these guys. And we're also going to be joined by Jeff Beachbum-Berry, who has written a number of seminal tiki books, and the most recent, Potations of the Caribbean, just came out about several months ago. And he is a busy, busy man and is now in the process of opening a tiki bar in New Orleans. So we're really happy to have both of these guys on the show.
Hey guys.
Hello.
Aloha.
Hey, Jeff.
Mahalo.
So we're just going to start with a quick rundown of what the Rum Rum Room is. So Joe, tell us what you've got going on in your house.
What's happening in your house, Joe?
Often I don't know. well, the Rum Rum Room is really my apartment. in Manhattan that I have with my wife, Nicole, that really started as an organic kind of thing. Like Nicole was an artist by background, and we've traveled quite a bit. So we've collected a lot of artwork, masks, carvings, and things, mm-hmm. and decorated our apartment as such. And we've been in New York about 11 years now. And, you know, as we our circle of friends have grown, we'd like to entertain. And so we would have people over. And it kind of started as just a Friday night place to be before it even had a name. And you know, and I'm glad Jeff is here because he's partly responsible for my demise in many ways. As it come to get more and more into cocktails in general, because we were here about 2003, so you did have a number of the cocktail bars open, you know, mm-hmm. the Milk and Honeys and the Death and Companies, et cetera, that we really enjoyed. But, you know, beyond that, you really couldn't get a lot of good drinks. And so mm-hmm. I took it upon myself just to learn more about it. Mm-hmm. And in 2006, I believe it was, I went to this tiki event called the Hookie Lau in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, where I attended a seminar put on by Mr. Jeff Berry as he attempted to make, you know, gardenia mix, which is this really messy, buttery, creamy thing you make in a blender, and it makes a huge mess. But then I found out that this, you know, Jeff Berry had written several books about, you know, tiki cocktails. And so being a person who was already into cocktails mm-hmm. and collecting classic cocktail books, I picked up Jeff's books, and then it's just been completely downhill from there. Mm-hmm. So we really took a tiki bent, and I brought all this knowledge in, and it became obsessive about collecting all the different rums you need. And so the Rum Room kind of just grew from there, from this large rum collection that we developed as we were trying to make each and every single drink that Jeff mm-hmm. you know, had in his books. And so we continue to entertain because you can't drink all these drinks yourself. Mm-hmm. And so you invite friends over. And then 2 years later, Jeff happened to be in New York, and he was in town, and he came over for a drink. And he gave us this slight mention in his blog in 2008. And that was right around the time of the Woodson and Fords and the super speakeasies in New York City, mm-hmm. the ones that nobody knew about. And because of this mention, we became a little bit of an internet sensation for about a week. You know, where is the Rum Room? Where is this Rum Room that Jeff is talking about? And so it kind of grew from there that people wanted to come see. Mm-hmm. They contacted me. And so the circle of friends that come to the parties, you know, just kind of grew and grew from there. Mm-hmm. So it's really a glorified house party in my home tiki bar.
I wish that you guys could see what Joe and Nicole look like when they're in full tiki regalia, because it's really beautiful. Nicole always has an orchid behind her ear and this beautiful bright red hair, and they just are the best tiki dressers I think that I've ever met.
Best dressed.
They're the best dressed couple. If we could vote. And I think this you know, the slight mention that you're talking about that Jeff can elaborate on is, it really speaks to how enthusiastic the tiki community is, and so enthusiastic that you build bars in your home, which I think is a really beautiful way to express this enthusiasm. And Jeff, you started out as a home bartender too, correct?
I still am one.
You still are one, and you're branching out.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So it's interesting because with Tiki 2, you know, we had discovered that there are people all over the country that have these home bars, and they vary in their level of elaborate. But it seems like even as Tiki has kind of gone through its ebb and flow, that it has in a way gone underground, and a lot of these individuals are preserving Tiki themselves. They've taken it upon themselves, and they're not relying on, you know, New York has struggled with Tiki. And they've taken it upon themselves to sort of preserve the tradition. And it seems like home bars kind of serve that function. I mean, you can speak to this, of course, because you've been maintaining your own home bar. Is there like a growing number of individuals that have home tiki bars?
Yeah, there is. There's a ton of them. And the reason why people started doing it and why I started doing it was because there was no other place to go mm-hmm. get a tiki drink. Mm-hmm. You had to build a home bar because there were no tiki bars you can go spend your money in. Unless you happen to live in Los Angeles or San Francisco, where there were a couple of old warhorse places like the Tiki Tea in L.A. or Trader Vic's was still around in San Francisco. But for the most part, in different parts of the country, and especially in New York, if you wanted to go to a tiki bar, you had to make one. Make one in your house. Mm-hmm. And so much of these bars is the atmosphere. I mean, going into a tiki bar, what you're really paying for is you're just renting a space. You're renting a seat so you can sit and have a little mini vacation for a couple of hours in a beautifully conceived Hollywood set-like Polynesian environment. So the drink in many of these places is almost beside the point, which is fortunate because in most places, even some really well-decorated ones, the drinks aren't really up to snuff. So a home bar is the only way you can have it both ways. You can have exactly the atmosphere you want, and you can also make the drinks to the proper specification so that they actually taste good.
Mm-hmm. Do you think these home tiki bars have had an influence on, you know, commercial tiki businesses, and especially now that we're seeing this kind of revival of tiki bars in select cities around the United States? Do you think that at all these individuals who have, you know, upheld the tradition had something to do with what's happening now?
Oh, absolutely. For example, Martin Cade, who runs Smuggler's Cove, which is routinely listed among the best bars of the world, is a, you know, it's a tiki bar. It's in San Francisco. He started off as a home bartender. He worked as an executive in a shipping company, liked tiki, built a home bar for himself, got so into it that he ended up working for Trader Vic's. There's one home bar success story right there. On a broader level, I think that home tiki bars have been in many ways responsible for the return of good quality ingredients on the marketplace, especially rums. I'm not sure that Ed Hamilton would have bothered to try and resurrect Lemon Heart 151 rum, for example, which is an essential rum in the Zombie and a lot of other tiki drinks, if there wasn't such a groundswell of people just clamoring for it in their home bars because there weren't enough tiki bars to really buy enough cases to make it viable otherwise. But from a commercial standpoint, it was really home bartenders who created that market. And now you see more and more boutique rums filling that, and you see more and more home bartenders buying them. Right. I think many more home bartenders than on-premise places.
And you starting off as a home bartender, actually branching out into your own bar in New Orleans, as we mentioned before. How is that going? How is the transition going?
It's amazingly interesting. I mean, that's a weird phrase, amazingly interesting. But it's really fascinating.
It's a tiki phrase.
Because
it's a perfect tiki phrase.
20 years as a home bartender, self-taught. Nobody, you know, told me anything except for a few old bartenders who just said, use a jigger. You know, that was about it. But when you're a home bartender, you have all the time in the world to make a drink to the fulfill its potential. If you want to take 20 or 30 minutes to make a Mai Tai, you can do it. If you want to spend 4 days making your own orange drop syrup before that, you can do that. If you want to go to buy rum at 5 different liquor stores, assuming you have a decent income, you can just cherry pick the best possible products for the drink. Now, when you try and transition into a bar where people are coming and paying and you have to pay rent and staff and all that, you get into a whole different thing. I mean, the way I describe it to people, and I guess you have to be from a certain generation to understand this analogy, is the original Star Trek series. You remember Spock playing that three-dimensional chess? redoing a recipe for a commercial tiki bar as opposed to home tiki bar is like going from just a regular chessboard to three-dimensional chess. Because at home, you're, as I said before, you're making the best possible drink, and damn the torpedoes, damn the cost, damn the time. You can just take it easy and do it right. Well, there's a little problem when you're trying to do that in a bar is that people are waiting for their drinks, and they're not going to wait 20 minutes for a drink. So the second level is, how do I make the best possible drink, and how do I do that quickly? Do I have to go through the recipe and try and recalibrate the amounts of every ingredient so that everything is a three-quarters of an ounce pour as opposed to a half an ounce and a teaspoon and 1 1/4 ounces and all that so that I can get the drink up quicker?
It's complicated.
Hear a little something in the background. Are you making a Mai Tai right now?
What can I get? I can't necessarily, legally, I can't go to an online company and buy a rum from Australia that doesn't have distribution here because legally in the U.S. you're supposed to go through a third-party distributor to buy your stuff. So if that local distributor doesn't have your product, you can't serve that that particular rum with that drink, which is, makes the best possible drink. So then you have to go figure out, okay, how do I do this? And how do I do this so that I can afford to do it? What rums are there on the market that I can afford, that I can work with and recalibrate this recipe?
Yeah. Joe is never going to open his own. Joe's never opening his own tiki bar.
Inventory is another thing. Like, maybe I can't really use 5 rums in this drink because I just don't have the space for all that rum. What can I do this rum? Can I do this drink with 3
Jeff.
Rums? All kinds of things like that.
When is your bar opening, Jeff?
We're opening in early October, and I'm really deep into the menu now. I've been working on some of these drinks for 5 years, and now that we're getting into the home stretch, it's really fascinating to see exactly what the last-minute tweaks are to try and make them viable in a commercial space.
Well, mm-hmm. we will for sure be visiting the next time that we are in New Orleans, and...
Joe is terrified now of opening his own tiki bar, and he's never doing it. He's here shaking his head, and he's like, he's sticking with the rum room.
Well, it's like they say, it's like the analogy they use with boats. You know, what's better than having a tiki bar, having a friend with a tiki bar?
Exactly.
That is right.
Exactly. Yeah. But we can't wait to host you all. I mean, it's the environment's, speaking of the environment, we've got Bosco Hernjack, who's probably the best tiki carver in the world, doing all our stuff for us. And I've got to collect, I didn't just collect tiki recipes, I collected tiki artifacts over the last 20 years, and all that's going into the bar. And we're just really stoked. We're really excited. We can't wait to open.
That's you have actually, the best carver in the world, the does. Best tiki carver.
Do you, Joe? Do you have any? Do you have a ton of carvings in your own home bar?
I do have a ton of carvings, but Jeff, being Jeff, he knows everybody, and everybody wants to work for Jeff. I would love to come down and work for Jeff, and he doesn't have to pay me.
You have a free employee.
You're hired. Yeah.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for joining us. That concludes our first episode of Punch Radio. Check us out at punchdrink.com. We will have a full week of Tiki Up next week. Mm-hmm. And that's everything from the Fern, which we thank very much for being here today.
This is sponsored by the Fern, and we wanted to thank our guests, Joe Desmond, Reagan Hoffman, Jeff Beach-Bunbury, and Tiki Adam for being here with us today, and we will see you soon. Or, well, you'll listen to us soon.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.